am grateful and honored to be among all of you today. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to share with you some of my thoughts. I was asked to speak on a book that I had written entitled The Journey Home. There are various perspectives in which I could share my thoughts with you. Today I would like to focus on the challenges I confronted in my life that caused me to question the very fiber of everything I was taught was true. When I was just a boy of about 7, I was always hearing about God being very loving. But I was confronted with several situations.
Complicated technology is not my good karma. When I was about 7 years old, I was confronted with parents of my best friends who I was told hated me because of my minority religion. In fact, I was told even God hated me. When you're that small and such words are coming from people your parents' age, it really has an impact. I was confused. Why is there so much hate in the name of a loving God? Is religion meant to bring about unity and love? Or is it meant to divide us and create hate? I couldn't intellectually reason it very well. I was just hurt and confused. As I grew a little older, my father went through bankruptcy. So when I was about 15, I had to get a job. And where I worked, everyone except my friend Gary and one other were African Americans from the ghettos of Chicago. This was in the mid-1960s. They were my parents' age or older. And I saw how beaten down they were by poverty and racial discrimination. There was no real equal rights. In the 1960s, if you were born African American in the ghetto, it was 99% for sure you would live and die in the ghetto. There was practically no opportunities, either in the North or the South. Yet every day, it was the law of the country. In school, before the class begins, we would pledge allegiance to our flag. And the last line was, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, where freedom and justice is guaranteed for all. And as a 15 or 16 year old boy, when I would say freedom and justice for all men are created equal, the inalienable right, the basis of our Constitution, I would think of these people that I worked with. I loved them. They were my friends. Every one of them was an alcoholic or a drug addict, not because they were bad people, but because that's the way they learned to cope with frustrations that were beyond themselves, the frustration of being hated. And I was being taught this is the greatest country of the world because there's liberty for all. Providing you're a certain color and a certain religion, didn't make sense to me. In the 1960s, it was a turbulent time in the United States of America. There was a war between two generations, the young generation and the old generation. Millions of people in their teens and early 20s formed a counterculture. They were protesting against an establishment of the older generation that they felt was hypocritical. Because those were the people at that age that were subjected to the draft. At that time, the military, if they called you for the army, once you turn 18, you're eligible for the army. If they call you, you have three choices. Go to the Vietnam War and fight and kill or be killed for a cause that you absolutely don't believe in, or go to jail and never be able to go to a proper college or get a good job for the rest of your life. Or escape from the country and go to a foreign land, probably never being allowed to come home. At that time, those were the three choices we had. And I was soon to become 18. And there were millions of boys being drafted by force. And I had friends who were drafted. Some were killed. Some came back invalids. And others were so traumatized they were drug addicts. It was a difficult time. Should I fight for something I really believe is wrong? So I joined the civil rights movement with the followers of Dr. Martin Luther King. And I protested against segregation due to the color of the skin and discrimination. And I was in one march, I was the only white person. It was in the South, in Florida. And other white people who were standing on the sides of the roads were cursing me and throwing stones on me. I had serious questions. Where do I belong? I heard Martin Luther King say, "If you do not have an ideal you're willing to die for, you have nothing meaningful to live for." I wanted to find that ideal. But for me, it wasn't possible just floating along with the current of what everybody else was doing, with the fashions or the fads, or the economic promises. In 1968, there was a Democratic convention in Chicago at Grant Park. And young people went to protest against the Vietnam War. And I just went there to figure out what's going on. And I was tear gassed and chased by police who were brutally beating people with clubs and arresting them and putting them in prison just for questioning in a free country. You see, my search was not out of curiosity. It was a sense of identity. A sense of where I could find dignity in my life. In that sense, it was desperation. One day, I was in New York City visiting a friend, and I got a call from a person I grew up with from about 9 or 10 years old. His name was Gary. He was my best friend. He was in New Jersey at a common friend's house. He said, "Please come. I have to talk to you." So I had no money in those days, so I hitchhiked. You know hitchhiking in India? You go like this, and if someone picks you up, you just go with them. And if no one picks you up, you stand like this. And usually no one would pick me up. Because in those days, being a part of the counterculture, I grew my hair long. Growing hair long was not a fashion. It was a statement of revolution against established hypocrisy. And people hated people with long hair. So I stood on the road and I got to New Jersey and my friend said, "Frank, our friend, wants us to go to Europe with him. He's willing to pay for both of us if we go." So that was a convincing argument. So I was on a little airplane to Iceland with my two friends, and then to Luxembourg. And in Luxembourg, we found out what type of facilities Frank was going to give us. Our first night was in a little tiny tent in a campground. And we found out there was a waterfall close by, just a small one. And it was the first time in my life I was outside of my country where I was born. I just felt so free. I could do anything, go anywhere. When we came back from bathing under the waterfall, all Frank's money had been stolen. He left it in the tent. So he went back to America the same day, and Gary and I were left with nothing. But we wanted to continue on this journey. And as I was traveling, I was going to museums and trying to get some messages of life from art. I was going to forests and riverbanks, trying to get some messages of direction in life from nature. And music. Music was a very important part of our life in the 1960s. The musicians were the heroes and the prophets. And somehow or other, Gary and I were hitchhiking. We went across the English Channel. The police harassed us for about 6 hours with threats and abuse because our hair was long. The immigration police. And finally they let us in. And we stood on the side of the road like this, grateful that we were allowed in to this country of UK. And our ride was going to an island, the Isle of Wight, where there was the biggest rock festival of the whole generation of the 60s. There was over 500,000 people there, listening to the most popular, successful bands. They didn't play ragas, they played rock and roll. And I was 19 years old at the time. And I remember I was there, and the music was so loud. To have speakers on the stage, they didn't have speakers everywhere, but they were right on the stage. And they had to be loud enough to really shatter the ears of 500,000 people, because that's what people liked in those days. And we would go right up front. And I was trying to be a part of the scene, but there was a silent calling that was from my heart, that was actually louder than all the music. And it seemed to be calling me away from all of this. I didn't know where, but I understood it was something spiritual that I was being called to find in my life. A few days after that rock festival, one of the great legends of the generation died of an overdose of drugs in England. 3 days before, I was sitting there watching him at the festival. His name was Jimi Hendrix. He was talented, incredible wealth, incredible fame. He had every type of sensual pleasure he could possibly want. Everything that everyone in this world is striving for, he had it to enormous dimensions. But yet, was he happy? If he was, why did he die of an overdose of drugs? I said a prayer for him. I remember I was sleeping on the floor of someone's house when they told me the news. But I remember thinking, what really is happiness? He had everything except happiness. I started going to monasteries, Catholic monasteries, Franciscan monasteries, synagogues, spending more times in the forests, going to big cathedrals and spending days just praying and reading different philosophical and spiritual books. We traveled through France, through Italy, and eventually my thirst for spirituality became so much. I found that the very things that all my comrades in the counterculture were rebelling against, we were the same. We just had a different dress and we created a different language. But the same type of egoism and selfishness and greed was within us. I heard Gandhi's words, that we should be the change we want to see in the world. And I understood personally that that change has to happen within ourselves. If we're not part of a solution, we're part of a problem. So my conclusion was that that change has to be spiritual. And eventually Gary and I were living in a cave in the Isle of Crete, which is south of Greece. It was really a beautiful place, quite simple. But if I had to classify it, it was a 5-star cave. In the sense, it was quite clean, and it was nice, there was good ventilation, but it was a cave, there was no furniture. We just slept on the stone ground. And every day, I would climb a mountain. And there, on the top, I would meditate, read holy books, and pray for direction. I believed in one God. I struggled. Is religion bad or good? It seems to be dividing people with so much hatred and so much prejudice, and everyone has absolute reasons to hate in the name of God. So if I want to find peace and be an instrument of peace, should I reject religion? It seemed like a good idea. But there was this inherent faith in the goodness of God and the goodness in the essence of all religions. And I was determined to find that essence. Once connecting with, we can understand the real purpose and truth of all the spiritual paths of the world. I was praying for direction. And it became so intense that I was obsessed with finding my direction in life. I told my parents I'd be back in 2.5 months. And almost 3 months passed. And there was no phone or post office in my cave. So I had no way to communicate with my parents, and I had no desire to do so because I knew it would break their hearts if I told them. I just couldn't go home and continue college. There was a calling that I had to answer. So I would cry for direction. And one night, as the sun was setting, I heard a voice. It was the loudest voice I ever heard, but it didn't have any sound. It was from within me. Spoke 3 words. And I knew if I follow these 3 words, nothing would ever be the same in my life. I would have to leave almost everything I thought I was behind. But I really believed it was the call of God. And I still do. Would you like to know what the 3 words were? Go to India. Now, this was in 1970. I had never met an Indian in my life. I had never eaten Indian food in my life. I had never tasted a chili pepper. I didn't know where India was. I didn't have a map. And I had not a single penny or any money to buy a map. But I was determined to go to India. I felt this is where my calling was taking me. It was perhaps the greatest challenge I was ever confronted with. Am I willing to do this? So I climbed back down the mountain and went into the cave. And my beloved friend Gary was sitting. He had a long beard and long hair. He was in meditation with a little candle next to him. And I meditated on another little part of the cave as we were looking out. The sun had already set. The moon was rising. The stars were in the sky over the Mediterranean Sea. And I said to Gary, something incredible happened to me tonight. Gary said, something amazing happened to me. I said, what happened? He said, you won't believe me. I said, I will believe you. Just tell me what happened. He said, no, you won't believe me. I said, I believe you. Tell me what happened. He said, at sunset, while I was on the ocean side in the sand, I heard a voice. I said, what did he say? He said, you won't believe me. I just said, just tell me, what did he say? Go to Israel. Where? He said, I told you you wouldn't believe me. I said, no, I just didn't hear. Where? He said, Israel. We should both go to Israel. God is calling us to Israel. Gary, he told me to go to India. He said, India? There was total silence because it was so shocking. For about 20 minutes, and I was just looking up into the stars. And I was crying because I felt so grateful. And I whispered into the sky, I'm ready to come. And then I said, Gary, I'm leaving at sunrise tomorrow for India. And he was really disturbed. He said, you're going to leave me all alone in this cave? You're insane. Hitchhiking through Europe with no money is one thing, but the Middle East through the deserts? You'll be killed. You can't do that. I said, Gary, I believe God is calling me there. The next morning at sunrise, I left him and started my journey to India. There's so many ways of hitchhiking. I hitchhiked by working on a little fishing boat to get back to Athens. And then I started hitchhiking. I met a couple people who wanted to also go to India. And we started going east. I believed if I just keep going in the eastern direction, someday I'll reach India. Went through Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan. It took 6 months from the time I left London to the time I reached the border of India. The 3 months that I was traveling through the Middle East, usually alone, I was getting all kinds of diseases because of the way I was living, but I was really meeting some of the most beautiful people and some of the most dangerous people I ever met in my life. Because when you're not a tourist and you're traveling, you're really completely dependent on a mercy beyond your own powers. And that was a nice thing for me. I think I aged about 30 years in those 3 months. But one situation I'll never forget, it really caused me to question again the very fiber of what we consider to be valuable. In Kandahar, Afghanistan. In those days, the people of Afghanistan were actually the friendliest, most charitable, hospitable people I had ever met. They would take me in their homes and give me food, simple flat bread, and they were just so kind. Somebody took me to a tea stall. The place was really in poverty. The tea stall was just a tiny shack where about 6 people could sit on the floor. And we were crouched down on our feet, but crouched down, and we each had a little tiny cup of tea. No milk, just tea and a little lump of sugar that was dissolving. And as we were sitting together, there was about 5 of us, very old Afghani men with turbans and their traditional clothes, very poor economically. At that time, it was night, it was dark, just a little lantern giving some light. A boy, he was probably about 15 or 16 years old. He came in. He was so thin, and his clothes were so old and dirty and torn up. And he had this little turban around his head that was so, it was rags. But the thing that affected me most was his eyes. He was blind. His eyes were swollen, discolored, and there was nothing covering them. I never saw anything that turned my stomach like that. It was really, from a material perspective, ugly. He couldn't see. He had a branch of a tree and a can nailed to one end of it and a wire across it. And that was a musical instrument. He was playing it. It wasn't melodious like a sitar or a guitar. It was blum, 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 blum. And as he was going blum, 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 he sang. He sang these songs, beautiful songs about his love for God. And as he was singing, there was such joy in his face that it seemed to light up the room. I was enthralled. For about 45 minutes, I just watched him. I felt transformed. I was thinking, the way I was brought up in my life, if you have wealth, if you have health, if you have beauty, if you have high education, you're going to be happy. This boy was in total poverty. He was in a diseased condition. He was illiterate. And yet, he's the happiest person I ever met in my life. What is happiness? Everyone's looking for happiness. What is it? We become so superficially entrenched in conceptions. We're told something will make us happy, but it doesn't at all. Happiness is a thing that is within ourselves. It's not something that we just grab from outside. If we're not happy within our hearts, we're not happy no matter what we have. He was happy. Just expressing his gratitude to God in his situation. And here I was, a teenage American boy in relatively good health, thinking, I want what he has. And when I started thinking like that, that was a culture shock. Eventually, I got to the border of India. 6 months later. Between Pakistan and India, there was a no man's land between two rival nations. And when I came to the border, I was rejected. They wanted money from me. And I had no money. I think I had 26 cents. And the immigration agent said I needed $200 minimum to come into India. In that no man's land where I was, there was no phones or post offices. I couldn't even go back into Pakistan because I only had a one-way visa. I pleaded. I cried. And I was totally rejected with guns pointed in my face. Go back. We have enough beggars here. About 6 hours later, the guard changed. And I went to the new guard and I cried. And I begged and I pleaded, just give me a chance. I promise you, just let me meet your... I've risked my life. I've given up everything of my past just to learn from your great nation, from your rishis and your sages and your people. Just give me a chance. Someday I'll do something for your people. The immigration agent, he was a Sikh gentleman. He looked in my eyes for a long time. He said, sometimes a man must follow his heart. I have been told by my commanding officer, the previous agent, that I must reject you unless you show me $200. But I am going to give you the chance that you're crying for. He stamped my passport and put his hand on my head and said, welcome to India. May you find what you are longing for. Within a week, I was in the Himalayas. And the first day I was there, I met a sadhu. I was just in a lonely place, and he told me to take off all my Western clothes and offer them to Mother Ganges. And he wanted to give me the robes of a sadhu. I said, what is a sadhu? I never heard the word before. He said, it's a wandering, homeless person who's seeking truth. And I thought, that sounds like me. So I threw my jeans and my turtleneck shirt in the Ganges and my underwear too, and put on a little kopan and a lungi and a chador, just simple cloth. And I traveled through the Himalayas. One person I met, his name was Kailash Baba. He wanted to teach me. I had already lived in caves with Himalayan yogis, and I lived with some very famous people and some people that the world really doesn't know. But this person, he was a very older man, and he wanted to teach me how to live in the jungle. How to eat when you're deep in the forest. What kind of herbs and fruits and berries and leaves you can eat and what types you can't. Which ones were medicinal when you get sick? I was fascinated. I had just turned 20 years old. It was really an adventure for me. He taught me how to live among our neighbors. There were no humans. There were leopards, panthers, wild elephants. I didn't see any tigers, but I saw all the others. There was wild boar. There were lots of snakes, cobras, vipers, mosquitoes, scorpions. And we were just sleeping on the ground at night. And I remember he told me, that this is their home. You are a visitor. If you have the slightest fear of them, or if you have any ego that you think you are superior to them in any way, they will kill you. And there's nothing you could do to defend yourself here. You have to see the equality of life. You have to understand the Atma, the living force within everyone. That person that's seeing through the eyes and hearing through the ears and tasting through the tongue and trying to find various pleasures and security in life. That living force is a part of God. And we're all brothers and sisters. Inequality is only on the mental and physical level, but on the spiritual level, there is true equality. To humble yourself before God is to learn to respect and love life in whatever way it exists, in its essence. If you see them as your brothers and sisters and respect them as such and give them the place that they need, they will respect you. He had been living in the forest. He was in his late 60s. Some people told me he was 150. I don't know. But he was in the forest for at least 50 years. Usually when you learn something in school, you have some time to memorize it or to imbibe it before the exam. But this was a crash course because those snakes and leopards were walking around us. But you know something? Because I was with Kailash Baba, not any merit of my own. Because I was with him, I actually had no fear. And I was actually feeling that these are my brothers and sisters. And there was no problem. And I was thinking, this is the power of associating with people who have faith and realization of that faith. They could transform us. It was so real. And another thing that was so real, he didn't speak a word of English. And I didn't speak any Hindi. I learned more from him, I was thinking, than any college that I went to in America without any communication through language. This was a great lesson for me. Because he so deeply cared about me as an eternal soul, as a brother, as a child of God, and because I was so eager to hear from him, that communication of wisdom came. And I could understand what he was saying, even if it was a different language, and I didn't understand the language. It was something of the heart. To actually care, to actually feel affection, is such an important part of education. And I remember while I was living in the jungles with Kailash Baba thinking, how am I learning so much from him and we can't talk to each other? It was kind of good. We couldn't gossip. But then I was thinking, of all the years I went to school, the one teacher that affected me the most was not the best academic teacher, but he was the person who really cared about me the most and encouraged me the most in my life. After some time, I traveled on. I came to a leper colony. It's a long story, but there was this old leper woman in rags, dying. She had no nose, no fingers, no toes. But her people harassed me, and she felt sympathy for me. She couldn't speak my language, but in her eyes, I experienced a mother's love. And she put her hand out to bless me, and I put my head under her hand, which had no fingers. And she was crying, crying as she was saying, "May God bless you, my son." She said it in Hindi, but I could understand that. "May God bless you, my son," again and again. And I was thinking, here is this woman, totally destitute, rejected by society. All she wanted was what any mother wants, to bless a child. And because I was giving her a chance to bless a child, she was in ecstasy, weeping in happiness and smiling. She didn't have teeth, but her smile was... I looked up at her. And I was living in a country in America where the most glamorous movie actresses were constantly on all the hoardings and in all the televisions and in all the theaters and all the magazines. And I looked up at this old leper woman and I was thinking, she's the most beautiful person I've ever seen. What was her beauty? It was beyond the skin. It was the motherly love that she was offering me from her heart. I wandered through your great land of India, living with yogis and rishis, living with the people of all varieties, living with lamas and rinpoches and sadhus, and was going to holy places. After leaving the Himalayas in Varanasi, I saw a funeral procession. And all the ladies were marching in the back of the procession, weeping. And I went and walked behind the ladies. They were crying so piteously. Then I saw something I never saw in America. They just took the body and put it on some logs and lit it on fire right on the riverbank in the Ganges. And I sat and watched as the body was consumed by fire. What is death? I was thinking, unless I understand death, I can't really understand life. And unless I understand life, I can't really understand death. So I sat from sunrise to sunset watching body after body burn. just trying to get a realization of what is this thing called death, and seeing all the tears of all the relatives as they were coming and going, body after body. And I became so convinced of the eternal nature of the Atma, or the soul. It's a long story I'm going to end with, because I think I'm out of time. But I don't know what time I'm supposed to end. I'm out of time? I should say a few things. Okay. I'm just going to say two more things, and it's not going to take long. I was in India for about a year, traveling like a sadhu from holy place to holy place, and from mountain to mountain, and forest to forest, and I especially love to live near holy rivers. And at a certain time, because I needed to get a visa extension, I was in Nepal, in a small village called Swayambhunath, where there's a temple, a Buddhist temple on top of a mountain called the Monkey Temple. So I was sleeping under a tree near a monastery, and one day I just decided to take a walk through a field. It was a rice paddy, and you all know rice paddies, during the monsoon season, which it was, they're really muddy, and there's just a little border that you could walk on between them. So I was walking on the border, and I saw massive dark clouds forming in the sky. And I understood there was going to be a monsoon downpour within moments. I was looking for some shelter, because I only had this one set of clothes the sadhu gave me about a year before. There was no houses as far as the eyes could see. There were no trees as far as the eyes could see. It was just rice paddies. And there was not a single human being. I was all alone, kind of in the middle of nowhere. And as it started drizzling, I looked a little closer in all directions, and I saw one old man walking on the border with an umbrella. So I thought, I'm going to get under that umbrella. And I was slipping on the edge, and I was somehow, I reached him from behind. I was walking really, really fast, almost running, and I got right behind him, and I got under the umbrella, and it started pouring, raining. And I was just right behind him, walking, walking. He never turned around. Two people, total strangers, walking under the same umbrella in a rice paddy where nobody else is around. We walked about 25 minutes or so. Then the rain stopped. And I said, thank you. And he turned around. When he turned around, he was so shocked, he dropped his umbrella in the mud of the rice paddy. It was Gary, my friend, who a year before I left behind in a cave in the Isle of Crete. He had gone to Israel. If you want to know the rest, you have to read the journey. But anyways, we were connected, and then I said, we went to Pashupatinath, and I prayed to Lord Shiva, please show me my path. Because I was learning so many things from so many people. And I felt something very deep inside, that something was going to be revealed to me. And then one sadhu said, we're going to Amarnath. It's a holy place in Kashmir where there's a cave where people go, and whatever your desire is will be fulfilled. And my desire was to find my guru and my spiritual path. So I said, Gary, we're going to Amarnath. So we went on a third-class train. In those days, they were free. Not because the railway was charitable, but because it was so crowded, the third class trains, that the ticket collector could never get in. There were no bars in the windows in those days. You just jumped in the window while it was moving if you wanted to get in. So we were in this train, and it got flooded in a field with massive downpour of rain, and the train couldn't move for about 20 hours. And there was no water, there was no food, there was no fresh air. You couldn't go out of the train because it was like just muddy water with snakes crawling around in a muddy field. And finally, about 28 hours or something later, the trains, after moving, came to a station. And Gary and I decided, let's crawl out a window and get some water and walk around and drink, breathe fresh air, and then we will go to Amarnath. So we did. Then we heard the whistle of the train, and it started moving. They were, in those days, steam engines. So I said, Gary, the train's leaving, let's get on. And we dove through a window, but we just bounced off human bodies. And then another one, and another one, and we tried to get into a door, and we just bounced off another human body mass. And the train was gone, and we couldn't get on, and we didn't know where we were. So I asked someone, a sadhu, who was just sitting on the railway platform. I said, where are we? He said, this is Mathura, Krishna's birthplace. And today is Janmashtami, Krishna's birthday. Come, I'll show you his birthplace. And I went there. There was about a million people. And I thought, this is something wonderful. I was charmed. And Gary wanted to leave the next day, or a couple days later, because it was very crowded. There were so many people there. And I went to Vrindavan. And I told Gary, I'll meet you at the Brahma Ghat under the clock tower in Haridwar in 4 days. But I want to stay here for a couple days. There's something happening to me here. So I was sleeping on the bank of the Yamuna River. And the morning I was supposed to leave, I had typhoid fever. I couldn't go. I couldn't communicate with Gary. He was gone forever, it seemed. And by the time I got better from my typhoid, the forest of Vrindavan, the path of bhakti, the concept of Radha, the feminine, compassionate, absolute truth, the feminine aspect of the absolute truth, the path of love, bhakti, and the people, their humility, their deep philosophical convictions that they were applying to their life in such simple, compassionate ways, I decided this is my path. And this is what I want to give my life to. So I decided I'm just going to stay in Vrindavan for the rest of my life. And a little later, Prabhupada, who later became my teacher, came through Vrindavan. And his compassion and his depth and the authenticity of what he was presenting, it affected me so deeply. I just wanted to assist him. So I was in Vrindavan for about 9 months, and my visa ended. But during those 9 months, what I was longing for, what I was searching for, what I was praying for, a window opened in which I could see where I really wanted to go on my journey home. Home is within each of our hearts. If we find that home within ourselves, we will feel home with family wherever we are. Thank you very much.